From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. We've all heard about the spread of coronavirus in the U.S. Half the 12 cases are here in California, but there are a couple of other aspects that have hit Los Angeles. One focused on businesses such as tourism and manufacturing. The other, xenophobia, as in Asian Americans were getting dirty looks for doing innocent stuff like blowing their nose. That and a lot more coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm E. Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up on the program, if you're a mom-to-be actually, thinking about using a doula, we'll have everything you need to know on that, a list actually, coming up in about 20 minutes. Plus, information on an LA County program is being set up to provide access to doulas in certain underserved communities, so stay tuned for that. Also, the 2 freeway, actually a dream to drive, but that wasn't always going to be the case. It was supposed to interact with the 101, which would have taken it right through Silver Lake.
All those restaurants, all those homes would have been demolished. And really, the character of Silver Lake would have been radically transformed if that freeway had gone through there.
Can't imagine that. We'll tell you what changed the plans later in the show. But we start with coronavirus and its impact on business here. Now, despite the alarming number of cases in China, more than 28,000 as of today, the spread of the virus in the U.S. has been limited. Health officials in Wisconsin confirmed on Tuesday the state's first case of coronavirus, bringing the total number of cases in this country to 12. But with China being hit so hard, it's businesses here in Southern California that are feeling the real pain right now. Robert Garoba has been tracking all this. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks.
All right, now, tourism, obviously a vulnerable area. Tell us what you're hearing from some of the major business districts in the area.
Well, the Beverly Hills Chamber of Commerce president, he said it's definitely a concern for them. It's too early to have any real accounting yet. But he's worried about a domino effect. If people aren't getting on the planes, they're not staying in the hotels, and then they're not buying stuff in all the stores there. I just got a little bit of info from the LA Tourism and Convention Board. They said they had a research firm do a forecast of what the outbreak could mean for the local tourism economy here. They're expecting a loss of 325,000 Chinese visitors to LA, and that would account for a drop in spending of more than $900 million this year. They say now they're working on diverting advertising dollars to places outside of China.
$900 million. That's more than I expected to hear, but you can imagine how big
that's
the impact
forecasted.
Is.
Yeah, forecast. Yeah.
Now, okay, so what are the specific types of businesses reporting problems, and what are they telling you?
So I did some reporting over last week on specifically LA area travel agents, and especially those who serve the Asian American community here. They are really feeling the effects of this. One guy told me they're hoping they can stay open to the end of the year because they're just getting so many cancellations of people worried or can't get a flight or other things. It's not just travel to China. It's also affecting businesses that rely on Chinese tourists coming here. Specifically, I know the tour companies are taking a major hit. I spoke with somebody at the National Tour Association yesterday, and he said the Chinese government has essentially shut down all group tours, both inside and the ones going outbound. So that's definitely affecting tours. And then that ripples down into the bus charter companies. Mm. I talked with one yesterday, a woman who said that usually they're getting 50-60% of their business from China. Now she's making phone calls and telling people she initially said no, that we got openings.
So yeah, they're scrambling on that front. Now, Hyundai and Airbus have reported problems with its supply chain because so much of China has just shut down. Some of the car parts, of course, produced there. What are you hearing from people here about the effect on supply shipments?
So that's still a little bit too early to have any real reporting on it. There's one expert at USC's U.S. China Institute I just got off the phone with. He says there definitely will be an impact. He said one major thing to think about with this is that a lot of companies have moved to what's called just-in-time production. So that means that they're not stockpiling parts and components from China in a warehouse somewhere. They're relying on things to get to them just when they need them. So if a lot of those parts and components aren't on a ship right now, those companies are going to be feeling the brunt of that very, very soon.
All right. That's KPCC's Robert Garoba. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Now, there is some good news, though, on the coronavirus front. A patient in Orange County, one of the six confirmed cases in California, has been released from the hospital in actually good condition. And epidemiologists say the disease poses low risk to people outside of China. But the thing is, that hasn't stopped xenophobia against Asians from spreading around the world, including right here in L.A. KPCC's Josie Huang covers Asian American communities and talked to locals about what they're experiencing. Hi, Josie.
Hi.
All right, so what are some of the stories you've been hearing about?
Well, from the folks I talk to and the stories you see on social media, you're hearing about Asian people getting dirty looks if they cough or if they sneeze or even if they're just clearing their throat. There was this one USC grad student I talked to. Her name is Cindy Liu, and she told me she noticed people on the USC campus staring at Asian students wearing face masks and trying not to walk too close to them. And then something similar happened to her, where she was on a campus shuttle and she was about to sit down. And then the passenger in the window seat scooched as far away as possible from her.
Now, sometimes it can be hard, very difficult to resist to say something to people. So did Cindy want to say anything to the other passengers?
Well, at the time, she was kind of like too stunned to react. But afterwards, she was like, oh, wow, I'm Vietnamese American. I've never been to China, but it doesn't matter to this other person because I look Asian. And even though I was born here, I'll always be the perpetual foreigner to some people, is what she was telling me. And the whole experience has gotten her to really feel more self-conscious. And she's actually changed her behavior. She was saying that now, to avoid weird looks, she no longer blows her nose in public. And she tries not to sneeze, which is hard
because it's
been really cold recently.
And sneezing is good. You're supposed to sneeze.
I know. Yeah. I know. So she's making herself physically uncomfortable to make other people comfortable.
Now, okay, as I mentioned earlier, the actual risk posed by coronavirus in the U.S. is very low. And certainly being Asian doesn't make you more likely of a carrier. Is that correct?
That is true. I mean, there's still a lot we don't know about the virus, and it's still not contained, but it's showing itself to be as contagious on the same level as SARS. If you can remember, that was back in 2003.
Yeah,
there was that outbreak where no one in the U.S. actually died. And another similar thing with SARS is all this anti-Asian sentiment we're seeing now. We saw back then there was this fear of, you know, being around Asian people back then or going to Asian businesses or restaurants. And you're seeing that again. One man I spoke to was telling me that he was in Alhambra, where he lives, when he overheard a group of friends walking by and they said, let's not go eat Chinese. We're going to get sick.
The one big difference, though, between 2003 and now is that there was no Twitter, there was no Instagram, no Facebook. So I could imagine that we're seeing a lot more online vitriol.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You're seeing posts all over those platforms you mentioned, also like TikTok, where people are writing racist things about Chinese people, describing them as dirty and eating really bizarre kinds of foods. And there's been a whole bunch of videos posted and reposted of Asian people eating bats, which is a possible vector for this disease. And even though these videos weren't apparently made in China, they've helped feed these racist tropes that go back centuries, really, of Chinese people being diseased and culturally inferior, the yellow peril. And you're seeing a lot of racial slurs thrown around on the internet by people who accuse Chinese people of just passing around this disease again.
Now, you mentioned earlier about Cindy that the targets of xenophobia are not limited to just people of Chinese descent.
Yeah, so true. So Cindy Liu, the USC grad student, she's Vietnamese American. I also spoke to Ren Fernandez Kim, who's Korean and Peruvian. She was at a Target in Pasadena the other day when she coughed into her elbow, like as you do.
Anyone else would.
Right.
Yeah.
But when she looked up, she saw this older couple glaring at her, and she was really taken aback by that. So she said she very awkwardly stared back, waved, and said, hi, and and just, you know, let the incident pass at the time.
Did Ren, like the USC student Cindy, did she feel more self-conscious after that happened?
Yes. She was telling me that she did feel, oh no, I made these people feel bad. But then she got mad at herself for feeling upset that she was making them uncomfortable because she did nothing wrong, right? All she did was cough. And so she went online to vent, which is actually how I found her, because she was tweeting that Asians that she knows are very conscientious. And the reason she and others wear masks is so, yes, that they don't get sick, but that if they do have a cold, they don't want to make others sick too. And that really resonated with a lot of people on Twitter, because she got over 40,000 retweets.
Wow.
So maybe some good came out of this uncomfortable experience she had.
Now, I know, Josie, you were just on a plane flying back from Asia recently. Was there anything that made you feel uncomfortable?
I personally was not uncomfortable being on a plane load with people who were all wearing masks. I was coming back from Taiwan for Lunar New Year, and I was wearing a mask, too, that my mom made me put on because mom.
Yeah.
And I had a scratch in my throat, so I coughed a little bit. And the man next to me, I saw him visibly stiffen and kind of like look at me. And he happened to be Asian, too. So at the time, I didn't feel like I was being racially profiled, but maybe he was nervous about being around me because I was Asian. So, you know, folks are getting suspicious of each other. So I spent the rest of the flight trying to make him not feel uncomfortable by suppressing like any tickle in my throat.
So you made yourself uncomfortable for him.
Yeah, kind of. I did.
Wow. That's Josie Huang. She covers Asian American communities for KPCC. Josie, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Okay, on a less serious note, do you think you always look terrible in your driver's license photo? Well, then you're in luck. A new law could give you up to 3 shots at getting just the right picture. It's called AB 2405, proposed last week by State Assemblyman Philip Chen from Diamond Bar. Now, he said it was partly inspired by his work last year when he asked Californians about how to improve the DMV experience.
One of the things that time and time again they've talked about was customer service.
Now, under his idea, for each extra picture you want, you'll be asked for a $5 voluntary donation that goes to driver education programs. Then you can pick the best one out of those 3. Now, it would be the second shot for this kind of law. A similar one was proposed in 2018 before it stalled out. But right now, if you wanted to get a new picture for your license, you'd have to pay upwards of $32 to get a duplicate ID. And in that case, you'd have no guarantee at all that you'd like the new pic they would take. But if this new law passes, however, then you'll be able to start supermodeling at the DMV on January 1st, 2022. Although if you need advice, Philip Chen says he's just a lawmaker, not a photographer.
I'm probably not the best person to ask.
So instead, get some tips from a pro, Tyra Banks.
Learn the power to smize. Smile with my eyes.
I only cry with my eyes. Then you'll be ready to work that camera and get that driver's license pic of your dreams. All right, when U.S. soldiers come home, whether for a short break or between deployments, or maybe they're home for good, that transition sometimes can be difficult. A lot of times, they don't have many people to talk to, especially ones that have any idea what they went through. But a new kind of therapy is like looking right in a mirror. We'll find out all about it on Take 2. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. A growing body of research is showing the value of peer counseling for military veterans returning to civilian life. Programs where former service members support each other have become common around the country and in some cases have been shown to be a lot more helpful than traditional mental health treatment. KPCC's Alyssa Jong-Perry reports for the American Homefront Project.
When Robert Hernandez got out of the Army in 2004 after doing a tour in Iraq, he moved back to the L.A. area. But the adjustment back to civilian life was hard.
I was sleeping on a futon in my parents' living room working at Home Depot. It was pretty much every day, if not every other day, that I was drinking.
This went on for about 11 years until a friend who he served in Iraq with saw him struggling. His friend called him up, asked if he wanted to work with vets in L.A. County through a program called Battle Buddy Bridge. It's a vet-to-vet peer program where vets go through a week-long training to become peer support specialists. After that, they can help other vets get connected with services like housing, military benefits, and even mental health care. Hernandez was sold. He became a peer support specialist and now is the program manager of Battle Buddy Bridge. For him, being around other military folks felt familiar.
the rapport that we build with these veterans, you know, and the connection we make, like talking about our experiences, like, man, I went through the VA and I had to wait 2 months for an appointment. Like, dude, I get it.
Vet-to-vet support isn't just for the mentee. It also helps the mentor, like Hernandez. In order to be a peer support specialist, you have to be enrolled in school. So Hernandez quit his job at Home Depot, signed up to take classes at the local college, and stopped binge drinking. His life has a purpose now, he says. So vets helping other vets is what makes this program unique. That's according to Dr. Shelley Jane. She's a psychiatrist with the VA Palo Alto and Stanford Medical School. And she studies peer support programs.
The peers are people who have a lived experience with PTSD, but they're further along in their recovery. The idea is they share their personal story of recovery, and they self-disclose about a lot of the obstacles and the issues that they faced.
Sharing your own personal journey and struggles is something that regular mental health professionals don't do. But Dr. Jane's research shows that vets greatly benefit from working with each other.
They report being more socially engaged, more hopeful and empowered about their futures, and they're more engaged in their mental health care.
Still, she says, it's not clear peer support programs actually help treat PTSD. Dr. Jane is studying that now.
All right, guys. So today we're going to talk
in the back room of a large, drafty office building, Hernandez leads a training session for mentees who want to be peer support specialists.
That's what our two reflection workshops are about, thinking about...
One of his tips, reflect back on your own experiences so you can be better equipped to help others. Joe Aguirre is one of the mentees in attendance. He spent 26 years in the Army, serving several tours in the Middle East. When he retired, he enrolled in classes at a local LA college. That's where he met a peer support specialist from Battle Buddy Bridge.
I felt comfortable talking to her about certain things, whereas I didn't with other people. It is relieving. I could just come in anytime.
Now he says he's looking to be the guy that vets come to for help. But he wants to learn more from experienced vets like Robert Hernandez. For Hernandez, he's been working at Battle Buddy Bridge for 5 years now. Next up, he says, a master's in social work so he can continue his work with vets.
It's like a little motivation for them to see, like, you know, there is help out there. There are people out there that want to help us.
And sometimes that help comes from the people who have lived through the same experiences. In Los Angeles, I'm Melissa Jung Perry.
All right, now to motherhood. Los Angeles is one of the several places around the country that are enlisting doulas to try and improve the birth outcomes for moms and babies. Specifically, the target is African-American mothers-to-be. That's because here in LA County, new black moms die at disproportionately high rates, and their babies are three times more likely than not to make it to their first birthday compared to white infants. KPCC's early childhood reporter, Mariana Dale, has been reporting on this. Hello.
Hi, A.
Okay, so first, let's clarify, what exactly is a doula? What do they do?
Well, let me start with what doulas are not. They are not doctors or midwives. They do not deliver babies. They don't give medical advice. They're another member of the birth team. And what they do is provide educational, emotional, and physical support during pregnancy, at delivery, and postpartum. And I know all of this because KPCC and LAS surveyed more than 20 California doulas, including Michelle Sanders, who wants to clear up some misconceptions.
So people think that doulas mean that you are having a home birth, unmedicated, you know, what people call like hippie or crunchy. And it's just like, no, whatever you want to do is what we'll support. It's not about how I would do it. I just want you to do what you want to do in a safe way.
And so here's an example she gave me on that. Sanders can go ahead and explain all of the medications that might be presented during birth so that when a doctor asks you about Pitocin, which is used to induce labor, people know exactly what they're accepting or declining.
I gotta admit, I thought it was hippie and crunchy too, what a doula does.
Yeah, so, see, yeah. That's why we're talking about it.
All right, so what are some more examples of what this support looks like?
So there are those three phases I talked about. So before birth, that's where doulas can help you make a plan for what kind of birth you want to have, with or without medication, help you with some stretches, help you prepare for baby, and basically just answer any questions that you might not have time to ask your doctor. Then there's the birth itself. They're going to help you advocate for that birth plan that you planned out. They might help with massage or other types of pain management techniques. And then after baby is there, there's postpartum. So maybe mom or the family needs help breastfeeding, a mental check-in, or maybe you just need someone to like do the dishes or watch the baby for long enough that you can take a shower. Doulas do all of that.
Is there any research that doing all of those things you just mentioned helps improve birth outcomes?
Yes. So there's been a couple of studies. A few years ago, there was one of Medicaid-funded births. It found that women who worked with a doula were less likely to have a preterm birth or a cesarean section. And then there's kind of an added financial bonus, which is that it saves health insurers nearly $1,000 per birth is what they found. Mm. And then the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has also said in the past that continuous support during birth, which is basically what a doula does, is one of the most effective tools to improve labor and delivery outcomes.
All right. All sounds great. Sounds great. But how are people paying for their services?
Yeah, where's the money? Yeah. Most of the time, that money is coming out of people's own pocket. There is a range. Some doulas charge a couple $100s. Others charge a few $1,000s.
What about health insurance for that?
That is the most frequent question that I've gotten as I've been working on these stories. Will my health insurance pay for it? And the related question, which is why won't my health insurance pay for it? And so I reached out to some of California's biggest health insurers, Blue Shield of California, LA Care Health Plan, United Healthcare, and Kaiser Permanente, and none of them cover doula services. It's not considered what they call essential to maternity care. Kaiser and LA Care Health Plan say they're actually looking into the possibility of covering these services in the future. And United Healthcare told me that people who have a health savings account or what's called an HSA should actually be able to use some of that money for a doula.
All right. So back to what's happening in LA County. What is the county trying to accomplish with its doula pilot program?
I'm going to let doula clinical consultant Nikisha Robinson actually answer that question.
We're hoping that the outcomes for the women that are participating are positive birth outcomes, that babies are going to full term, that babies are living and thriving.
And here's the plan for that. This pilot program is going to provide free doula services to African-American moms in specific parts of the county, and there's going to be a priority for people that use Medi-Cal.
All right, so what happens next?
Well, there is a hope that these types of pilot programs can prove that doulas really do improve outcomes in a significant enough way that maybe Medi-Cal or private insurers are going to cover these services. Oregon and Minnesota, for example, those are two places where doulas are considered a covered service for Medicaid. And in the meantime, I should mention there are also some community groups that are working to offer doula services at free or low cost. They're kind of filling in the gap.
All right, that's KPCC Early Childhood Reporter Mariana Dale. Mariana, thanks a lot.
You are welcome. And if it's possible that UA or anyone out there still has questions about doulas, you can.
I might.
You might. Well, I can tell you where to go.
Okay.
You go to our website, laist.com. That's laist.com.
All right, now to a remembrance.
I'm Spartacus.
At the center of one of Hollywood's most iconic moments was one of its most iconic actors, Kirk Douglas.
From Spartacus to Vincent Van Gogh, there's a single thread drawing all his characters together, and it's called conscience. Every person he ever played had one.
That's Steven Spielberg presenting an honorary Oscar to Douglas, who passed away yesterday at the age of 103. Like his characters, Douglas displayed a sense of conscience in real life, too, as his commitment to improving LA's playgrounds was well known. Through their foundation, Kirk and his wife Anne funded over 400 playgrounds throughout the city.
The facilities, the playgrounds, the recreational areas at schools in LAUSD, they were severely neglected. So that was part of the impetus for creating the fund.
That's Lauren Kay, Director of Communications for Community Partners, an organization that worked with Douglas to refurbish playgrounds around the city.
They really, really cared about this issue. And Mr. Douglas, along with his wife, also showed up at almost every playground opening there were, and there were a lot.
Now, not only did Douglas show up to the playground openings, he often tested out the facilities as well.
I saw a picture of him going down the slide alongside Mayor Villaraigosa at one of the playground openings, and I believe the caption said he was 93 at the time.
Oh, I'd do it too. Douglas will be remembered as a force for good, both on the silver screen and on the schoolyard slides. All right, when I learned how to drive in the late 80s, one of the things I worried about the most was getting on the freeway. How fast do I go on the on-ramp? What if the other drivers don't want to give me some space? Should I speed up, slow down, or just stop and cry? And then when I'm on the freeway, changing lanes really freaked me out because, you know, LA drivers and all. Well, lucky for me, when my uncle was teaching me to drive the freeways, he took me to the one place where I would have room to learn, space to drive, and that is the 2 freeway. We'll find out about its history coming up when Take 2 continues. Stay with us. All right, I got a lot of news to get to all afternoon here on KPCC. Nick Roman, host of All Things Considered, is here to tell us what he has cooking.
Well, the Trump administration has offered to send more money to Los Angeles to help fight the homelessness crisis, but it comes with strings attached. And today we got an update from Mayor Eric Garcetti about how that process is going. KPCC's Carolyn Champlin will have our story. Pros and cons of a cashless economy, with some businesses now accepting only credit cards or mobile payments. And a lot of critics argue the practice discriminates against people who are low income. I actually pulled cash out the other day, and people were sort of freaked out at the store that I was at.
No. And they didn't know what this was. What,
yeah,
is,
what
this?
Is this? This green stuff here. And the Chili Bowl may become an L.A. monument. What is the Chili Bowl, you might ask? We will explain that coming up. KPCC and LAist food editor Elena Shatkin will explain the significance.
Now, you know, everybody out there doesn't know this, but Nick Roman today is celebrating 15 years here at KPCC. I remember being a wee lad, a small child, Nick, hearing you on the radio here at KPCC.
Yeah, it's been a great thing. I've been on air and All Things Considered also since 2013, and it's been the greatest joy of my life.
Yeah, you've been here before the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before this building, right? On the campus of Pasadena City College.
Well, and this building here where we are, when we redesigned it, I've always described it the way it used to look was, if you ever see the warehouse in Law and Order where the dead body is, that's what this place looked like then.
Built on the shoulders of Nick Roman. Nick,
yeah,
thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. As Angelenos, we spent much of our time in the car, a total of 119 hours a year on average, if you go by one account from last year. And much of that is on a freeway. Now, but because we're all in this together, we decided to have a little fun with it. Now, earlier this week, we put up a little poll asking people to name their favorite freeway. The options were Route 2, the 110, the 405, or other. Now, we figured since most of you are forced to drive these freeways pretty regularly, you're bound to have a favorite, at least one that you can actually tolerate. Now, for me, nothing prettier than being on the 134 West between Pasadena and Glendale when you can see the downtown LA skyline to the left and Griffith Observatory straight ahead. Driving it, I mean, never fails to give me that I love LA feel. Now, many of you, the 2 freeway, it's the one that won your hearts, it picked up almost 40% of the votes. It's a sentiment echoed by Brenda Rees, who wrote a love letter to the freeway for the Eastsider last year, and we asked her to come read it.
There is nothing more pure for the seasoned Los Angeles driver than swooping up and over the most glorious freeway ever constructed, the State Route 2. Known to us in Northeast Los Angeles who love it, the 2. The freeway that always makes you wish you had a convertible. The 2 that takes you away. As a route, the SR2 extends beyond our NELA boundaries. But as it traverses its way from the frenetic streets of Santa Monica through Beverly Hills and West Hollywood, I don't know how this congested boulevard is the 2, it only gets really interesting when it hits our turf.
Yes, I'm gonna be a star.
This is where the two throws off its unassuming cloak of ordinary and transforms into an engineering marvel that promises and delivers an exhilarating driving experience with matching natural scenery. Sorry, 110 Arroyo Seco Freeway. Sure, you have quaint light fixtures and really nice bridges, curvy stretches, and knuckle-biting on and off ramps, but for wide-open driving pleasure, the two puts you in the backseat. Merging transitions is just one of the reasons to embrace the two as the freeway most like an airstrip. A steady climb leads to a beautiful curved transition to the westbound 134, to the north 2. However, the slow ascent into the atmosphere from the eastbound 134 to the north 2 is an adrenaline-charged, aeronautical dramatic. Driving like you are flying does not get any better than leaving La Cañada on the 2 southbound heading into Nila. Flanked by the San Rafael Hills that are currently dotted with white buckwheat, flowering aloe, and orange stringy dodder, also known as witch's hair, the supreme view of downtown Los Angeles unfolds as you descend. Go ahead. Gasp. Going south to north paints a different story, one of enticing adventure. Enter the 2 off Alvarado Street near Echo Park, and suddenly you are transported onto a highway to heaven. Through Glassell Park, Highland Park, and Eagle Rock, you follow a wide open ridge through eastern Glendale. The official Glendale Freeway culminates at La Crescenta Valley, but SR2 continues for a short spell on the Foothill Freeway and then off at Angeles Crest Highway for a windy good time through the verdant and wooded San Gabriel Mountains, where it meets its termination at the edge of Victor Valley in the Mojave Desert. Phew! Let us all pay closer attention as we transport ourselves on the 2, admiring the views, the clean construction lines, the often emptier lanes of traffic. But watch out for wildlife. Deer, possums, and raccoons have been known to linger at the side of the road, and unfortunately a mountain lion was killed while trying to cross the 2 back in 2014. Our spirits can soar with the eagles on the 2, but let's keep our eyes on the road, on this magnificent engineering marvel.
That was writer Brenda Rees reading her piece, In Love with the 2, an Ode to a Northeast LA Freeway, which ran in the East Sider last year. All right, now you heard her. For wide-open driving pleasure, the 2 it is. Stretching 87 miles from Echo Park to the San Gabriel Mountains, it's scenic, 5 lanes wide and relatively empty. But once upon a time, the 2 was supposed to be a much bigger roadway. Originally, it was designed to cut through Silver Lake and intersect with the 101, continue west through Hollywood and into Beverly Hills all the way to the 405. In fact, it was known as the Beverly Hills Freeway. So, what happened? Well, that's the topic of today's Throwback Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Robert Peterson is the host of the Hidden History of Los Angeles podcast. He's here to tell us some of that transit history. Hello, Robert.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, remind us, where does the modern day 2 freeway go exactly?
Well, the modern day 2 freeway on the northern end starts at the 210 freeway up near La Crescenta and Glendale, and then it travels south past the 134, and then it passes the 5 freeway, and then it ends in Echo Park and dumps you out on Glendale Boulevard.
And quickly, south. Right after the 5 freeway.
It exactly.
Ends, like, right away. And the funny thing is, that's where I learned how to drive on the freeway, because back in the late yes. 80s, early 90s, there was hardly anyone on the 2 freeway, so you could kind of learn how to speed up and merge into traffic lanes, and that was my freeway learning experience, because there was no one on the 2.
So I love it. And then eventually they take you to the 110, the Arroyo Seco, or the Pasadena Freeway,
that
and that's
was a
the
nightmare.
Expert level.
That was a nightmare. That was, yeah, a few months down the road. All right, so the 2 ends in Echo Park. That was not the original plan. What happened?
So, well, first thing, if you step back, you need to understand that early LA city planners actually envisioned many more freeways than we currently have. For example, in 1959, state highway engineers planned a 1,500-mile freeway network crisscrossing the LA region. No neighborhood was to be more than 4 miles from a freeway. And initially, these plans looked like it would become a reality. During the early 1960s, the growth of freeways seemed unstoppable.
Yeah.
But by the late 60s and the early 1970s, funding issues, rising construction costs, community opposition, protracted litigation, environmental concerns, and appeals for mass transit options other than freeways all contributed to an uncertain future for freeways in Los Angeles.
And so it was going to be called the Beverly Hills Freeway, right? Once it extended past into Beverly Hills?
Exactly, exactly. So you can still see a little remnant of that. So right now where the freeway ends in Echo Park, it was going to continue through Echo Park and Silver Lake, intersect with the 101 at Vermont. And today, if you ever drive down the 101 in Vermont, you'll notice there's a lot of open space. That is actually because they had envisioned that connectors right there. So that it was supposed to connect with the two right there. And Caltrans, when they designed that freeway, designed a lot of extra space for that connection. Obviously, it never came to be. And we have a public storage space and a lot of empty space at the Vermont exit. But then it would travel west all the way to the 405, roughly in between Santa Monica and Melrose. Which is something I think a lot of people, when driving to the west side, probably, oh, I'd love to drive a freeway all the way to the west side.
It would be amazing. It would be so convenient.
It would be convenient. One thing also to think about, I mean, you're always balancing with freeways with convenience. And, of course, it would probably be full of traffic now. But
No, I know. I say that and then I realize it. Yeah.
But, I went to law school at UCLA, and there were many times I was sitting on Olympic and Sunset and thinking about,
wishing you were on a freeway,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. But, you know, you look at, one thing, if you ever think about the corner in Silver Lake of Silver Lake Boulevard and Sunset, where all those restaurants are, the freeway would have gone right through there. So all those restaurants, all those homes would have been demolished. And really, the character of Silver Lake would have been radically transformed if that freeway had gone through there.
Ultimately, the Beverly Hills Freeway, what killed it, though? What was the nail in that coffin?
Well, probably, I would say, there were disputes between the city, the county, and the state.
Oh, wow.
There was also funding problems. Freeways got more and more and more and more expensive. And then finally, community opposition. Interestingly, actually, the city of Beverly Hills initially supported the freeway, and a lot of Century City developers supported the freeway. But as Beverly Hills then started opposing the freeway. And then once you had a lot of community opposition, just like we've seen with the 710, the trying to finish that, it's hard. You need a lot of political will, and that just wasn't there.
So how does the present day 2 freeway tell the story of its past?
The 2 freeway that we drive today really exhibits the different phases of freeway construction in Los Angeles. The first portion of the freeway, running through Glassell Park, was initially completed in 1958, during the heyday of freeway construction. Yeah. While the last portion of the freeway to be built, in between the 134 and the 210, was completed 20 years later in 1978, when freeway construction in LA was in serious decline. And finally, the stump in Echo Park survives as a symbol of kind of the abandonment of the freeway as our solution to transportation needs. I also think of it as kind of like a memorial to the never-built freeways of Los Angeles.
There are more than one. That's the thing. That's what we're kind of known for now in a weird way.
Definitely. I mean, there were many freeways that early city planners envisioned, which just never came to fruition.
Yeah. So how's the history of this freeway shape present-day transit?
It's kind of funny. I think there are some echoes of the neighborhood opposition to the Beverly Hills Freeway from Beverly Hills. When you start seeing some of that opposition today to the Purple Line extension, I think you see a lot, a long history in LA of people opposing transportation. And some of the reasons are obviously different, but some segments of the community in Los Angeles are afraid of transportation or don't want it in their backyard.
That's Robert Peterson, host of the Hidden History of Los Angeles podcast. He spoke with us today about the 2 freeway and why it ends in Echo Park. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
All right, we've heard about how Southern California coastal communities are dealing with, or in some cases, fighting over sea level rise. Now, while some might think that having our beaches washed away is a tomorrow problem, there's a place, the Pacific Ocean, where that is a very real today problem, as in it might not be there that much longer. Coming up, find out where it is, what they're doing, and how we can learn here in Southern California. That's coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. There's a new way to buy a home in L.A., but you must be willing to co-own property with strangers. It's called Tenancy in Common, or TIC for short. TICs could help moderate income buyers finally become homeowners and start building wealth. But an opportunity for some could be a loss for others. KPCC's David Wagner explains.
Christopher Stanley with Vanguard Properties unlocks the door to a sunny two-bedroom unit he's showing at an open house in Hollywood.
This building has a little bit of a craftsman, you know, 1920s feel.
This unit is listed at $529,000.
I would say it's about 15% lower than a comparable condo. TICs in LA are definitely a discount.
Prospective buyers walk along the new hardwood floors, inspecting the renovated kitchens and smelling the fresh paint. One of them is restaurant owner Sean Nee. He currently rents nearby.
Yes, I lived in this area for 20 years. My son goes to school in this area, so we're trying to find something where we've lived for a long time.
He says other listings around here are way out of their price range.
We would not be able to afford anything in this area. We definitely wouldn't be able to afford a single family home, that's for sure.
Tenancy in Common is generally cheaper because it's a way of buying property in LA that's relatively new. Some would say unproven and risky. So far, only two lenders will work with TIC buyers in LA. You can't get a fixed interest rate on your mortgage. And unlike a condo, you're not buying just your unit. You're buying a fraction of the entire building and signing an agreement with people in the other units to share property taxes and other responsibilities. Co-owning with strangers isn't for everyone, but brokers say it appeals to a lot of buyers.
It really opens up homeownership to more people.
Liz McDonald runs a brokerage called The Rental Girl. She sold dozens of TICs in recent years and has many more in development.
It's a way to help renters get their foot in the door because what's happening is renters who are qualified to buy but can't afford it, they're saving and saving and saving, and the market is growing faster than they can save.
LA home prices have skyrocketed more than 73% since 2011. Most people's incomes haven't come close to keeping up. Tenancy in Common may help some renters currently shut out of homeownership, but TICs are pushing other renters out. That's because TICs in LA are typically created by removing tenants from old, rent-controlled buildings in desirable neighborhoods and then renovating them for sales. That's what's happening to this building on a quiet street in Los Feliz.
Hello?
It's a bit creepy walking up to the apartment where Matthew Nauzer and Elizabeth Abrams live with their preschool-aged son. Their building is empty, almost totally dark.
It's a ghost town. We're the only light in the building. We've been here on our own for 4 months.
Nauzer and Abrams were the last holdouts in their building. They finally had to accept that they couldn't stop the new owners from converting to TICs. Cardboard boxes fill their dining room as they pack to leave for a new home in Lincoln Heights. The couple negotiated a buyout, but Nauzer wishes they could stay and fight longer.
I'm just not sure why it's so easy for a developer to displace families just by filling out the paperwork and paying the fee. I think very few people are thinking about the human factor.
The couple had planned to send their son to school here, but now they're leaving behind an area with one of LA's most desirable public schools. It's just one of the reasons they're heartbroken to have to leave the neighborhood.
There's so many families on this block in particular, and the whole area is so walkable and great. The longer we were here, the more friends we made.
A representative from the company converting their building said their goal is to create affordable homeownership. Abrams doesn't buy it.
Okay, so you're trying to bring affordable housing to the housing market by displacing people from rent-controlled units. How is that better? How is that helping?
Prospective TIC buyer Sean Nee says he understands how displaced renters feel. He's on the market because he's getting evicted from his rent-controlled apartment.
The emotions are pretty new. You know, we're just trying to, like, focus on finding a place to live and just, like, survive and take care of my son.
LA City Council is considering a plan to track conversions to find out how many rent-controlled apartments the city is losing to TICs. Nee says he doesn't have time to wait for the city to fix its lack of affordable housing. For now, he'll do whatever is best for his family. Covering the economy, I'm David Wagner.
All right, now to the environment. As we face the potential threats associated with climate change, we may have some things to learn from our neighbors in the Pacific. A Pacific island nation called Kiribati is projected to be the first country lost to sea level rise. Now, to prepare, their government is building seawalls and bought land in Fiji as potential refuge. But some residents say they have bigger concerns than climate change. Monique Myers is a California Sea Grant Extension specialist, and she works on problems in coastal and marine environments. She visited Kiribati and wrote about her experience in an op-ed for the Sacramento Bee. Monique Myers, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, I described you as a Sea Grant Extension specialist. What does that mean? What kind of work do you do?
My colleagues and I work on applied research and outreach education. So all kinds of different topics from climate change to coastal ecosystem issues.
Now, and how's it? And how's your job funded? How is that kind of work funded?
It's federal dollars that go through universities. So now, it's a Sea Grant College program. Mm-hmm.
Now, you went to Kiribati last October for 9 days. Describe the island and the people who live there for us.
Well, flying in, it is really spectacularly beautiful. It's just, you know, a turquoise atoll in the center of the Pacific, and actually really the very center of the Pacific. And Kiribati itself is a chain of many islands. And so I should say I just went to Tarawa, and I was in South Tarawa, where the majority of the population lives. And the people there are just wonderful. I mean, they're really welcoming and happy, and, you know, you couldn't ask for nicer people.
Now, okay, scientists have been predicting that Kiribati will be lost to sea level rise for years. What has the country done to prepare?
They certainly are working on building some sea walls and infrastructure. I know a previous president had purchased some land in Fiji for potential climate refugees, but I believe at this point they're thinking about staying still.
Now, the sea walls at this point, would they help, or is it too late?
Well, you know, I guess it just depends when the next big storm comes, you know. And so, you know, I don't know how long the seawalls will last, or it will help for the short term. But I think for the long term, there's probably other solutions they need to consider.
We're talking about the island of Kiribati with Monique Myers, a California Sea Grant specialist. Now, when it comes to evidence of sea level rise on the island, are we seeing any of it that's changing things there, changing the environment specifically?
Well, I was only there for 9 days, so I didn't get to see the change. But, I mean, I understand from what I've read that they have seen, you know, saltwater inundation. And during a storm several years ago, they definitely had buildings destroyed. And I saw buildings that were pretty surrounded by water. So I think things have probably changed.
So how are the people themselves, though, handling these changes? I mean, it's one thing to try and physically do things to save things, but they have to live there.
We actually did a quick survey just to see what was at the top of their mind for coastal marine resources. And there's just things that are more pressing to them, like there's a lot of pollution and sanitation issues, and their biological resources are, you know, things that they have to think about for day-to-day living that they're, I think, more concerned about, understandably. You know, when you're there, you pretty much understand why that is.
Is that one of the, at its core, one of the hardest things for people to realize when it comes to issues such as sea level rise, and that it always just seems so far away? I'll deal with it later, whenever later happens to be. I got something I got to deal with now.
Well, I think that's true for all of us, right? So I think that's true here. I think it's easy to think about Kiribati as being this far away land where, you know, they have this problem of sea level rise, and here we're starting to really become aware of it, but I don't think we've really taken the action that we really need to think about what the future is going to be like for us. And to, like, I think of a lot about our beaches and to protect our sandy beaches into the future and our beach culture, that we really need to be more forward acting, not just thinking, but acting.
Yeah. And in your op-ed, you draw a comparison between Kiribati and the threat facing California's beaches. Is that what you're thinking about when you try to compare the two, that maybe here in California, we need to make that a little bit more top of mind than it is?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. So basically, Kiribati has a whole culture that they are looking at losing, you know, when they lose their very low-lying atolls. But here in California, our beaches are very threatened. And in the next 30 years, we're looking at a turning point where we're losing a large portion of them, and maybe two-thirds by 2100. And we are the origin of beach culture. And so really, we are losing, you know, a very important part of all our culture if we let the foundation, the beaches, you know, disappear without looking forward and looking towards how we can allow them to persist into the future.
With our minds on Kiribati and then thinking about us in California, what are we not understanding about how things could change, how life could change 30 years from now or 40 or 50 years from now if our beaches go away?
Well, I mean, it's a very different situation in Kiribati where they're losing potentially everything, where we have a lot of elevation, we have a lot of places to go, we have so many options. So I really wanted to put a positive spin on this in that we have amazing options and resources that we can deal with that Kiribati does not have. But we can, you know, learn that the future, you know, they've experienced a lot more sea level rise than we have, but we are looking towards doing that. So we need to really take this seriously and look at where we can allow beaches to move inland, you know, so that the ecosystems and our culture, the recreational and all the other, you know, the activities we do with our beaches persist into the future.
So because of where we're situated here in California and what we have around us, we actually have a chance to be a little bit ahead of the game if we so choose.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's definitely a positive message that we have options. We just need to start planning because 30 years is not that far away.
That's California Sea Grant Extension Specialist Monique Myers. Monique, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
All right, that's it for us today. We're going to be back here tomorrow to reflect on the wild week it was in politics, but on a much different note. Did you know you can get really good chicken sandwiches at car washes in the San Fernando Valley? Really, it's a thing, but I got to warn you, they're spicy.
So it is crispy, it is juicy, but the heat is overwhelming right away. It feels like Satan's hand is wrapped around my tongue and he's squeezing it. Wow.
Yeah. It hurts. We'll tell you all about it tomorrow. And if you missed any part of today's Take Two, just head to wherever you get your podcast. Look for us, Take Two. There we will be. We're also all over social media on Twitter at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.